Chapter 6. Family. Landon Park Lane had been with me in the Crimea in 72. He lost a leg to a landmine and his best friend to a military blunder. His best friend was my brother, Anton. And Landon testified against him at the hearing that followed the disastrous charge of the Light Armored Brigade. My brother was blamed for the debacle. Landon was honorably discharged. I was awarded the Crimea Star for gallantry. I didn't speak to him for 10 years, and now we're married. It's funny how things turn out. Thursday next. Crimean reminiscences. Honey, I'm home! I yelled out. There was a scrabbling noise from the kitchen as Pickwick's feet struggled to get a purchase on the tiles in his eagerness to greet me. I had engineered him myself when you could still buy home cloning kits over the counter. He was an early version 1.2, which explained his lack of wings. They didn't complete the sequence for 2 more years. He made excited plock-plock noises and bobbed his head in greeting, rummaged in the wastebasket for a gift and eventually brought me a discarded junk mail flyer for Lorna Doone merchandising. I tickled him under the chin and he ran to the kitchen, stopped, looked at me and bobbed his head some more. "Hello!" yelled Landon from his study. "Do you like surprises?" "When they're nice ones!" I yelled back. Pickwick returned to my side. Plock, plock some more and tugged the leg of my jeans. He scuttled off to the kitchen again and waited for me at his basket. Intrigued, I followed. I could see the reason for his excitement. In the middle of the basket, amongst a large heap of shredded paper, was an egg. "Pickwick!" I cried excitedly. "You're a girl!" Pickwick bobbed some more and nuzzled me affectionately. After a while, she stopped and delicately stepped into her basket, ruffled her feathers, tapped the egg with her beak, and then walked round it several times before gently placing herself over it. A hand rested on my shoulder. I touched Landon's fingers and stood up. He kissed me on the neck and I wrapped my arms around his chest. "I thought Pickwick was a boy," he asked.
"So did I."
"Is it a sign?" "Pickers laying an egg and turning out to be a girl," I replied.
"What do you mean? You're going to have a baby, Land?"
"No, silly. You know what I mean."
"I do?" I asked, looking up at him with carefully engineered innocence.
"Well?"
"Well, what?"
I stared into his bright, concerned face with what I thought was a blank expression. But I couldn't hold it for long and was soon a bundle of girlish giggles and salty tears. He hugged me tightly and placed his hand gently on my tum.
"In there.
A baby."
"Yes. Small pink thing that makes a noise. 7 weeks. Probably appear July-ish."
"How are you feeling?"
"All right," I told him.
"I felt a bit sick yesterday, but that might have had nothing to do with it. I'll work until I start waddling and then take leave. How are you feeling?"
"Odd," said Landon, hugging me again, in a very nice kind of elated sort of way.
"Who can I tell?"
"No one quite yet. Probably just as well. Your mum would knit herself to death."
"And what's wrong with my mother's knitting?"
asked Landon, feigning indignation.
"Nothing,"
I giggled.
"But there is a limit to storage space."
"At least the things she knits are recognizable," he replied. "That jumper your mum gave me for my birthday. What does she think I am, a squid?" I buried my face in his collar and held him close. He rubbed my back gently and we stood together for several minutes without talking.
"Did you have a good day?" he asked at last.
"Well," I began, "we found Cardenio. I was shot dead by an SO-14 marksman, became a vanishing hitchhiker, saw Yorick Kane, suffered a few too many coincidences, and knocked a Neanderthal unconscious."
"No puncture this time?"
"2, actually, at the same time."
"What was Kane like?"
"Difficult to say. He arrived at Volskamper's as we were leaving."
"Aren't you even curious about the marksman?"
"Yorick Kane is giving a talk tonight about the economical realities of a Welsh free trade agreement."
"Landon," I said, "it's my uncle's party tonight. I promised Mum we'd be there."
"Yeah, I know.
Are you going to ask me about the incident with SO-14 now?"
"All right," sighed Landon.
"What was it like?"
"Don't ask." My Uncle Mycroft had announced his retirement. He was 77, and following the events of the prose portal and Polly's imprisonment in I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, they had both decided that enough was enough.
The Goliath Corporation had been offering Mycroft not one but two blank checks for him to resume work on a new prose portal, but Mycroft had steadfastly refused, maintaining that the portal could not be replicated even if he had wanted to. We took my car up to Mum's house and parked a little way up the road. "I never thought of Mycroft retiring," I said as we walked down the street.
"Me neither," he replied.
"What do you suppose he'll do?"
"Watch Name That Fruit, most likely.
He says that soaps and quiz shows are the ideal way to fade out."
"He's not far wrong," added Landon.
"After a few years of 65 Walrus Street, death might become something of a welcome distraction." We heaved open the garden gate and greeted the Dodos, who all had a bright pink ribbon tied round their necks for the occasion. I offered them a few marshmallows, and they pecked and plucked greedily at the proffered gifts. The front door was opened by Wilbur, who was one of Mycroft's sons and had reached middle age well before his time. Landon thought he did it on purpose, as though he could somehow accelerate through the days of work and get to retirement and golf just that little bit sooner.
"Hello, Thursday,"
he enthused, ushering us inside.
"Hi, Wilbers. All well?"
"I'm very well,"
replied Wilbur, smiling benignly.
"Hello, Landon. I read your latest book. It was a big improvement on the last one, I must say."
"You're very kind," replied Landon dryly.
"Drink?"
He offered us both a glass and I took mine eagerly. I had just got it to my lips when Landon took it out of my hands. I looked at him and he mouthed,
"Baby."
"Blast! Hadn't thought of that."
"I was promoted, you know," continued Wilbur,
walking through the hall and towards the living room. He paused to allow us to murmur a congratulatory sound before continuing.
"Consolidated useful stuff always promote those within the company that show particular promise, and after 10 years in pension fund management, Constuff felt I was ready to branch into something new and dynamic. I'm now services director at a subsidiary of theirs named Microtech Developments."
"But my goodness, what a coincidence," said Landon sarcastically. "Isn't that Mycroft's company?"
"Coincidental," replied Wilbur forcefully. "As you say, Mr. Perkup, the CEO of Microtech, told me it was solely due to my diligence. I..."
"Thursday, darling,"
interrupted Gloria, Wilbur's wife. Formerly a Volskamper, she had married Wilbur under the accidental misapprehension that A, he would be coming into a fortune, and B, he was as intelligent as his father. She had been wrong, in a spectacular fashion, on both counts.
"Darling, you're looking simply divine. Have you lost weight?"
"I've no idea, Gloria, but you're looking different." And she was. Habitually dressed to the nines in expensive clothes, hats, makeup and lashings of what have you, tonight Gloria was dressed in chinos and a shirt. She hardly wore any makeup, and her hair, usually perfectly coiffured, was tied up in a ponytail with a black scrunchie.
"What do you think?"
she asked, doing a twirl for us both.
"What happened to the £500 dresses?" asked Landon.
"Bailiffs been in?"
"No, this is all the rage. And you should know, Thursday, Female is promoting the Thursday Next look. This is very much in at present."
"Ridiculous," I told her, wondering if there was an end to the ludicrous media spin-offs from the whole Air thing. Cordelia had gone so far as to license jigsaw puzzles and action figures before I had a chance to stop her. I wondered if she'd had a hand in this, too. "If Bonzo the Wonder Hound had rescued Jane Eyre," I asked, trying to keep a straight face, "would you all be wearing studded collars and smelling each other's bottoms?"
"There is no need to be offensive,"
replied Gloria haughtily, as she looked me up and down.
"You should be honoured. Mind you, the December issue of Female thinks that a brown leather flyer's jacket is more in keeping with the look. Your black leather is a little bit passé, I'm afraid. And those shoes, hell's teeth."
"Wait a moment," I returned.
"How can you tell me that I don't have the Thursday Next look? I am Thursday Next."
"Fashions evolve, Thursday. I've heard that next month's fashions will be marine invertebrates. You should enjoy it while you can."
"Marine invertebrates?" echoed Landon.
"What happened to that squid-like jumper of your mum's?"
"We could be sitting on a fortune."
"Can neither of you be serious?" asked Gloria disdainfully. "If you're not in, you're out. And where would you be then?"
"Out, I guess," I replied,
Land, what do you think?
Totally out, Furs.
We stared at her, half smiling, and she laughed. Gloria was a good sort once you broke down the barriers. Wilbur, seizing the chance to tell us more about his fascinating new job, carried on as soon as his wife stopped talking.
I'm now on £20,000 plus car and a good pension package. I could take voluntary retirement at 55 and still draw 2/3 of my wage.
What is the Spec Ops retirement fund like?
Crap, Wilbur, you know that.
A slightly smaller and more follicularly challenged version of Wilbur walked up.
Hello, Thursday.
Hello, Orville, how's the ear?
Just the same. What was that you were saying about retiring at 55, Will?
In all the excitement of pension plans, I was forgotten. Charlotte, who was Orville's wife, also had the Thursday next look. She and Gloria fell eagerly into untaxing conversation about whether leather shoes in the look should be worn above or below the ankle, and whether a small amount of eyeliner was acceptable. As usual, Charlotte tended to agree with Gloria. In fact, she tended to agree with everybody, about everything. She was as hospitable as the day was long. Just don't get caught in an elevator with her. She could degree you to death. We left them to their conversation, and I walked into the living room, deftly catching the wrist of my elder brother Joffy, who had been hoping to give me a resounding slap on the back of my head, as was his 35-year-old custom. I twisted his arm into a half Nelson and had his face pressed against the door before he knew what had happened.
"Hello, Joff," I said, "slowing up in your old age."
I let him go. He laughed energetically, straightened his jaw and dog collar, and hugged me tightly, while proffering a hand for Landon to shake. Landon, after checking for the almost mandatory hand buzzer, shook it heartily.
"How's Mr. and Mrs. Doofus, then?"
"We're fine, Joff. You?"
"Not that good, Thurs. The Church of the Global Standard Deity has undergone a split."
"No," I said, with as much surprise and concern in my voice as I could muster.
"I'm afraid so. The new Global Standard Clockwise Deity have broken away due to unresolvable differences over the direction in which the collection plate is passed round."
"Another split? That's the third this week."
"Fourth," replied Joffy dourly, "and it's only Tuesday. The standardized pro-Baptist conjoined Methodarian Lutherian Sisters of something or other split into two subgroups yesterday. Soon," he added grimly, "there won't be enough ministers to man the splits. As it is, I have to attend 24 different breakaway church groups every week. I often forget which one I'm at, and as you can imagine, preaching to the idolatry friends of Saints Vox the Consumer, the sermon that I should have been reading to the Church of the Misrepresented Promise of Eternal Life, can be highly embarrassing. Mum's in the kitchen. Do you think Dad will turn up?"
I didn't know and told him so. He looked crestfallen for a moment and then said,
"Will you come and do a professional mingle at my Les Arts Modernes de Swindon show next week?"
"Why me?"
"Because you're vaguely famous and you're my sister."
"Yes?"
"Okay."
He tugged my ear affectionately and we walked into the kitchen.
"Hello, Mum."
My mother was bustling around some chicken vol-au-vent. By some bizarre twist of fate, the pastry had turned out not at all burned and actually quite tasty. It had thrown her into a bit of a panic. Most of her cooking ended up as the culinary equivalent of the Tunguska event.
"Hello, Thursday. Hello, Landon. Can you pass me that bowl, please?"
Landon passed it over, trying to guess the contents.
"Hello, Mrs. Next," said Landon.
"Call me Wednesday, Landon. You're family now, you know."
She smiled and giggled to herself.
"Dad said to say hello,"
I put in quickly before Mum cooed herself into a frenzy.
"I saw him today."
My mother stopped her random method of cooking and recalled for a moment, I imagine, fond embraces with her eradicated husband. It must have been quite a shock, waking up one morning and finding your husband never existed. Then, quite out of the blue, she yelled,
"DH-82, down!"
Her anger was directed at a small Tasmanian tiger that had been nosing the remains of some chicken on the table edge.
"Bad boy," she added in a scolding tone.
The Tas tiger looked crestfallen, sat on its blanket by the aga, and stared down at its paws. "Rescue thylacine," explained my mother. "Used to be a lab animal. He smoked 40 a day until his escape. It's costing me a fortune in nicotine patches, isn't it, DH-82? The small re-engineered native of Tasmania looked up and shook his head. Despite being vaguely dog-shaped, this species was more closely related to a kangaroo than a Labrador. You always expected one to wag its tail, bark, or fetch a stick, but they never did. The closest behavioural similarities were a propensity to steal food and an almost fanatical devotion to tail chasing.
"I miss your dad a lot, you know," said my mother wistfully. "How..."
There was a loud explosion, the lights flickered, and something shot past the kitchen window.
"What was that?" said my mother.
"I think," replied Landon soberly, "it was Aunt Polly." We found her in the vegetable patch, dressed in a deflating rubber suit that was meant to break her fall, but obviously hadn't. She was holding a handkerchief to a bloodied nose.
"My goodness!" exclaimed my mother. "Are you okay?"
"Never been better,"
she replied, looking at a stake in the ground and then yelling,
"75 yards!
"Rightio!"
said a distant voice from the other end of the garden. We turned to see Uncle Mycroft, who was consulting a clipboard next to a smoking Volkswagen convertible.
"Car seat ejection devices in case of road accidents," explained Polly, "with a self-inflating rubber suit to cushion the fall. Pull on the toggle and bang! Out you go. Prototype, of course."
"Of course." We helped her to her feet and she trotted off, seemingly none the worse for her experience. "Mycroft's still inventing, then," I said as we walked back inside to discover that DH-82 had eaten all the vol-au-vent, main course, and the trifle for pudding.
"DH,"
she said crossly to the guilty-looking and very bloated Task Tiger.
"That was very bad. What am I going to feed everybody on now?"
"How about thylacine cutlets?" suggested Landon. I elbowed him in the ribs and Mum pretended not to hear. Landon rolled up his sleeves and searched through the kitchen for something he could cook quickly and easily. It was going to be hard. All of the cupboards were full of tinned pears.
"Have you anything apart from canned fruit, Wednesday?
Mum stopped trying to chastise DH-82, who, soporific through gluttony, had settled down for a long nap. "No," she admitted. "The man in the shop said there would be a shortage, so I bought his entire stock." I walked down to Mycroft's laboratory, knocked, and when there was no reply, entered. Usually the lab presented an Aladdin's cave of inventive genius, the haphazard and eclectic mix of machines, papers, blackboards, and bubbling retorts a shrine to disarray, an antidote to order. But today it was different. All his machines had been dismantled and now lay about the room, tagged and carefully stacked. Mycroft himself, having obviously finished testing the ejection system, was now tweaking a small bronze object. He was startled when I spoke his name, but relaxed as soon as he saw it was me.
"Hello, love,"
he said kindly.
"Hello, Uncle. How have you been?"
"Good. I'm off on retirement in... don't touch that. In 1 hour and 9 minutes. You look good on the telly last night."
"Thank you. What are you up to, Uncle?"
He handed me a large book.
"Enhanced indexing. In a Nextian dictionary, godliness can be next to cleanliness, or anything else for that matter."
I opened the book to look up trout and found it on the first page I opened.
"Save time, eh?"
"Yes, but..." Mycroft had moved on.
"Over here is a Lego filter for vacuum cleaners. Did you know that over £1 million worth of Lego is hoovered up every year, and a total of 10,000 man-hours are wasted sorting through the dust bags?"
"I didn't know that, no."
"This device will sort any sucked-up bits of Lego into colours or shapes according to how you set this knob here."
"Very impressive."
"This is just hobby stuff. Come and look at some real innovation."
He beckoned me across to a blackboard, the surface covered with a jumbled mass of complicated algebraic functions.
"This is Polly's hobby, really. It's a new form of mathematical theory that makes Euclid's work seem like little more than long division. We have called it Nextian geometry. I won't bother you with the details, but watch this."
Mycroft rolled up his shirt sleeves and placed a large ball of dough on the workbench and rolled it out into a flat ovoid with a rolling pin.
"Scondo," he explained. "I've left out the raisins for purposes of clarity. Using conventional geometry, a round scone cutter always leaves waste behind. Agreed?"
"Agreed."
"Not with Nextian geometry. You see this pastry cutter? Circular, wouldn't you say?"
"Perfectly circular, yes."
"Well," carried on Mycroft in an excited voice, "it isn't. It appears circular, but actually it's a square. A Nextian square. Watch."
And so saying, he deftly cut the dough into 12 perfectly circular shapes, with no waste. I frowned and stared at the small pile of discs, not quite believing what I had just seen. How?
Clever, isn't it? He chuckled. Admittedly, it only works with next-gen dough, which doesn't rise so well and tastes like denture paste, but we're working on that.
It seems impossible, Uncle.
We didn't know the nature of lightning or rainbows for 3.5 million years, Pet. Don't reject it just because it seems impossible. If we closed our minds, there would never be the gravitube, antimatter, post portals, thermos flasks.
Wait, I interrupted. How does a thermos fit in with that little lot?
Because, my dear girl, replied Mycroft, cleaning the blackboard and drawing a crude picture of a thermos with a question mark. No one has the least idea why they work.
He stared at me for a moment and continued.
You will agree that a vacuum flask keeps hot things hot in the winter and cold things cold in the summer.
Yes.
Well, how does it know? I've studied vacuum flasks for many years and not one of them gave any clues as to their inherent seasonal cognitive ability. It's a mystery to me, I can tell you.
Okay, okay, Uncle. How about applications for next-gen geometry?
Hundreds. Packaging and space management will be revolutionized overnight. I can pack ping pong balls in a cardboard box without any gaps, punch steel bottle tops with no waste, drill a square hole, tunnel to the moon, divide cake more efficiently, and also, and this is the most exciting part, collapse matter.
Isn't that dangerous?
Not at all, replied Mycroft airily. You accept that all matter is mostly empty space? The gaps between the nucleus and the electrons? Well, by applying next-gen geometry to the subatomic level, I can collapse matter to a fraction of its former size. I will be able to reduce almost anything to the microscopic.
He stopped for a moment and regathered his thoughts.
Miniaturization is a technology that needs to be utilized, explained Mycroft. Can you imagine tiny nanomachines barely bigger than a cell building, say, food protein out of nothing more than garbage? Banoffee pie from landfills, ships from scrap iron, it's a fantastic notion. Consolidated, useful stuff are financing some R&D with me as we speak.
At Microtech Developments?
Yes, he said sharply. How did you know?
Wilbur said he had got a job there. By coincidence, of course.
Of course,
affirmed Mycroft, who never supported or admitted to any sort of nepotism. On the subject of coincidences, Uncle, any thoughts on why they are and how they come about? Mycroft fell silent for a moment as his huge brain clicked over the facts as he understood them.
Well, he said thoughtfully, it is my considered opinion that most coincidences are simply quirks of chance. If you extrapolate the bell curve of probability, you will find statistical abnormalities that seem unusual but rare, in actual fact quite likely, given the amount of people on the planet and the amount of different things we do in our lives.
I see, I replied slowly. That explains things on a minor coincidental level, but what about the bigger coincidences? How high would you rate 7 people in a Skyrail shuttle all called Irma Cohen, and the clues of a crossword reading out, Meddlesome Thursday Goodbye, just before someone tried to kill me? Mycroft raised an eyebrow.
That's quite a coincidence, more than a coincidence, I think.
He took a deep breath.
Thursday, think for a moment about the fact that the universe always moves from an ordered state to a disordered one. That a glass may fall to the ground and shatter, yet you never see a broken glass reassemble itself and then jump back onto the table.
I accept that.
But why doesn't it?
Search me.
Every atom of the glass that shattered would contravene no laws of physics if it were to rejoin. On a subatomic level, all particle interactions are reversible. Down there, we can't tell which event precedes which. It's only out here that we can see things age and define a strict direction in which time travels.
So what are you saying, Uncle?
That these things don't happen is because of the second law of thermodynamics, which states that disorder in the universe always increases. The amount of this disorder is a quantity known as entropy.
So how does this relate to coincidences?
I'm getting to that, muttered Mycroft, gradually warming up to his explanation and becoming more and more animated each second. Imagine a box with a partition.
The left side is filled with gas, the right a vacuum. Remove the partition and the gas will expand into the other side of the box, yes?
I nodded.
And you wouldn't expect the gas to cramp itself up in the left-hand side again, would you?
No.
Ah, replied Mycroft with a knowing smile. Not quite right. You see, since every interaction of gas atom is reversible, sometime, sooner or later, the gas must cramp itself back into the left-hand side.
It must?
Yes. The key here is how much later. Since even a small box of gas might contain 1,020 atoms, the time taken for them to try all possible combinations would take far longer than the age of the universe. A decrease in entropy strong enough to allow gas to separate, a shattered glass to reform, or the statue of St. Zvulks outside to get down and walk to the pub is not, I think, against any physical laws, but just fantastically unlikely.
So, I said slowly, what you are saying is that really, really weird coincidences are caused by a drop in entropy?
Exactly so, but it's only a theory. As to why entropy might spontaneously decrease and how one might conduct experiments into localized entropic field decreasement, I have only a few untried notions that I won't trouble you with here. But look, take this, it could save your life.
He picked up a jam jar from one of the many worktops and passed it to me. It seemed the contents were half rice and half lentils.
I'm not hungry, thanks, I told him. No, no, I call this device an entroposcope. Shake it for me.
I shook the jam jar and the rice and lentils settled together in that sort of random clumping way that chance usually dictates.
So? I asked. Entirely usual, replied Mycroft. Standard clumping, entropy levels normal. Shake it every now and then. You'll know when a decrease in entropy occurs as the rice and lentils will separate out into more ordered patterns. And that's the time to watch out for ludicrously unlikely coincidences.
Polly entered the workshop and gave her husband a hug.
Hello, you two, she said. Having fun?
I'm showing Thursday what I've been up to, my dear, replied Mycroft graciously.
Did you show her your memory erasure device, Crofty?
No, he didn't, I said.
Yes, I did, replied Mycroft with a smile, adding, you're going to have to leave me, pet. I've work to do. I retire in 56 minutes precisely.
My father didn't turn up that evening, much to my mother's disappointment. At 10:05, Mycroft, true to his word, and with Polly behind him, emerged from his laboratory to join us for dinner. Next family dinners are always noisy affairs, and tonight was no different. Landon sat next to Orville and did a very good impression of someone who was trying not to be bored. Joffy, who was next to Wilbur, thought his new job was utter crap, and Wilbur, who had been needled by Joffy for at least 3 decades, replied that he thought the global standard deity faith was the biggest load of phony codswallop he had ever come across.
Ah, replied Joffy loftily, wait until you meet the Brotherhood of Unconstrained Verbosity.
Gloria and Charlotte always sat next to each other. Gloria to talk about something trivial such as buttons, and Charlotte to agree with her. Mum and Polly talked about the Women's Federation, and I sat next to Mycroft.
What will you do in your retirement, Uncle?
I don't know, Pet. I have some books I've been wanting to write for some time.
About your work?
Much too dull. Can I try an idea out on you?
Sure. He smiled, looked around, lowered his voice, and leaned closer.
Okay, here it is. Brilliant young surgeon Dexter Colt starts work at the highly efficient yet underfunded Children's Hospital, doing pioneering work on relieving the suffering of orphaned amputees. The chief nurse is the headstrong yet beautiful Tiffany Lamp. Tiffany has only recently recovered from her shattered love affair with anesthetist Dr. Burns and...
They fall in love? I ventured. Mycroft's face fell.
You've heard it then?
The bit about the orphaned amputees is good, I said, trying not to dishearten him. What are you going to call it?
I thought of Love Among the Orphans. What do you think?
By the end of the meal, Mycroft had outlined several of his books to me, each one with a plot more lurid than the last. At the same time, Joffy and Wilbur had come to blows in the garden, discussing the sanctity of peace and forgiveness amidst the thud of fists and the crunch of broken noses. At midnight, Mycroft took Polly in his arms and thanked us all for coming.
I have spent my entire life in pursuit of scientific truth and enlightenment, he announced grandly. Of answers to conundrums and unifying theories of everything. Perhaps I should have spent the time going out more. In 54 years, neither Polly nor I have ever taken a holiday, so that is where we're off to now.
We walked into the garden, the family wishing Mycroft and Polly well on their travels. Outside the door of the workshop, they stopped and looked at each other, then at all of us.
Well, thanks for the party, said Mycroft. Pear soup followed by pear stew with pear sauce and finishing with bomba surprise, which was pear, was quite a treat. Unusual, but quite a treat. Look after Microtech while I'm away, Wilbur, and thanks for all the meals Wednesday. Right, that's it, concluded Mycroft. We're off.
Toodaloo!
Enjoy yourselves, I said.
Oh, we will,
he said, bidding us all goodbye again and disappearing into the workshop. Polly kissed us all, waved farewell and followed him, closing the door behind her.
It won't be the same without him and his daft projects, will it? Said Landon.
No, I replied. There was a tingling sensation like an electrical storm in summer as a noiseless white light erupted from within the workshop and shone in pencil-thin beams from every crack and rivet hole, each speck of grime showing up on the dirty windows, every crack in the glass suddenly alive with a rainbow of colours. We winced and shielded our eyes, but no sooner had the light started than it had gone again, faded to nothing in a crackle of electricity. Landon and I exchanged looks and stepped forward. The door opened easily and we stood there staring into the large and now very empty workshop. Every single piece of equipment had gone. Not a screw, not a bolt, not a washer.
He isn't just going to write romantic novels in his retirement, observed Joffy, putting his head round the door.
No, I replied.
He most probably took it all so no one else would carry on with his work. Mycroft's scruples were the equal of his intellect. My mother was sitting on an upturned wheelbarrow, her dodos clustered around her on the off chance of a marshmallow.
They're not coming back, said my mother sadly.
You know that, don't you?
Yes, I said, giving her a hug.
I know.